From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A couple of centuries before William Shakespeare, there was Geoffrey Chaucer. Chaucer blazed such a trail with Canterbury Tales and other poems that he, not Shakespeare, has been called the father of English literature. However, it's been a generation since the last biography of Chaucer was published. Until now, that is. My guest today is out with a fascinating new take on Chaucer, his travels, his adventures, and his big egalitarian message for his countrymen and countrywomen. This hour on Point, how Geoffrey Chaucer channeled the human soul. And you can join us. Do you know the Canterbury Tales, or has it been a while since you read it, or are you about to have a great hour discovering him? And tell us, what do you think it is about the Canterbury Tales that makes it so interesting and relevant today? The idea of a bunch of different people from different parts of life sitting around telling each other stories. Really interesting. Well, joining us from Oxford, England is Marion Turner. She's a professor of English at Oxford University's Jesus College, and her new book is titled Chaucer, A European Life. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Marion Turner, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me.
A pleasure to have you. So, you know, we have a big diverse audience here at On Point. There are probably many great fans of Chaucer listening, but for those who need a little brush up on his significance in English literature, can we just start there? Just place for us the Canterbury Tales in terms of the canon of English literature at large. Why is it still considered to be one of the most important books in English literature?
Yeah, so Chaucer was, in fact, the person who invented the iambic pentameter, which became the building block of English poetry, the form that people such as Shakespeare used in later centuries. He wrote an incredible range of texts, so all kinds of different things. He could turn his hand to any genre, really. And I think that's one of the key aspects of his success across the centuries. You know, if you like romances or saints' lives or bawdy vulgar stories or philosophy or short lyric poems, whatever you like, Chaucer did it. He really did all kinds of different things. And I think the Canterbury Tales in particular is so appealing because what he does is he gets together this diverse group and he says, it matters to listen to what everyone has to say. We shouldn't just listen to stories that are told by important people, by people of high social class. Everyone has a story to tell. And if you only listen to stories by one kind of person, you're not getting the full picture. You know, we all need to open our minds and listen to people that we might immediately not think we want to listen to. And I think that's a message that's relevant in every era.
And we hadn't seen that before, the mid-14th century in any English text?
Yeah, I think that's true to say. So Chaucer has sources which use this idea of the tale collection. And so one of the main sources is an Italian poem called the Decameron by Boccaccio. And this is a tale collection where lots of people get together and they all tell stories to pass the time. But all the tale tellers are of the same social class. They're all gentles. They're all of a high social class. And it's really different to get together this group that Chaucer gets together so that it's not just a knight. There's only one knight. The other people are a merchant, a sailor, a pardoner, a cook, a miller, as you mentioned before, this real range of people. And they don't tell stories according to their hierarchical importance. They interrupt each other. Right. So he really puts forward this idea of let's have a marketplace of ideas. Let's listen to lots of different kinds of people.
Yeah. You know, I have to say I was very, very fortunate in my education. I had an extremely brilliant ninth grade English teacher. So Mr. Tom Rohde, if you're listening, I remember. He had us read Canterbury Tales and the Decameron, actually, side by side. But that was also a long time ago, so I'll admit to you that my memory is a little bit dusty. So let's get a sense of a flavor of the Canterbury Tales in the original Middle English. So we're going to hear the famous opening lines from the general prologue of Chaucer's great work. Here it is, read by Neville Coghill.
One that April with his sure sorter the drucht of March hath persed to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor. When Zephyrus ake with his sweeter breath, in spirit hath in every halt and heath the tendra croppers, and the younger sunna hath in the ram his half a corsi runna, and smaller foolers maken melodia, that slepen all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh hem natur in her garages, than longend folk to go on pilgrimages.
A reading of the original text of the prologue of the Canterbury Tales, done there by Neville Coghill. Marion Turner, explain to us what's being said here.
Yeah, so the Canterbury Tales opens by describing the arrival of spring. So it's very timely that we're talking in springtime right now. So it begins by saying what happens every year. So when April's sweet showers pierce the drought of March, then the flower is born. When the west wind pierces the meadows, then crops come forth. And at this time, people want to go on pilgrimage. So these opening lines talk about the eternal cycles of life. So the fact that spring will always follow winter. There's always going to be fertility. The crops grow, children are born. These things have to happen. And these things are important in secular life and also in sacred life, because springtime in the Christian calendar is also about Easter, following on from Lent. So sexual desire and religious desire kind of go hand in hand.
But it's a fixed view, though, of life.
Exactly. So it's putting forward a sense of stability. So even though it's about change, paradoxically, it's also about stability. These things always happen. We can rely on these cycles of life. And that sense that things don't change, we might relate also to the feudal idea of life. So the idea that you will do the same job as your father did, and you will work for the same man whose father your father worked for, so that things don't really change. We're in a fixed world order, and we move forward through these cycles year after year. So that's the very opening sentence. But then what's so interesting about the Canterbury Tales is that Chaucer completely subverts our expectations, because after this long, beautiful, magisterial opening sentence, we then get something completely different. And if I can just read a few lines.
Oh, please. Yeah.
We then get Chaucer says, well, befell that in that season, on a day, in Southwark, at the tabard, as he lay, ready to wenden on me pilgrimage, to Canterbury, with full devout courage, at nicht was come into that hostelry, well 29 in a company of sundry folk, by adventure if fall in fellowship, and pilgrims were they all. So after this opening about the cycles of life, he then says, befell, it just happened that I was in a slightly dodgy pub in a slightly dodgy area just south of the river in London. And so we've got a complete change of tone. And then he says, it just happened, you know, it befell. And by adventure, just by chance, this group of people all came together in for a pilgrimage group. It might have happened differently. It's no longer this sense of the eternal stability, things happening inevitably. He's saying it just happened. Something else could have happened, but it didn't. And this is very much related to a mercantile view of life rather than the feudal idea that I was just talking about. It's the idea that things happen because of chances and opportunities that you take. You know, you can actually seize some control and decide you're going to have a go at a different mode of life. So we've got this kind of juxtaposition between feudalism and mercantile life. And of course, we've now moved into this mercantile zone. We're in an inn, a place where things are bought and sold. And Chaucer himself came from a mercantile background. He wasn't from the nobility. His father was a wine merchant, a vintner, someone who bought and sold things for a living.
So how was this sudden transition right there in the prologue of the Canterbury Tales? How was that read in the 14th century? Was it considered, I don't know, subversive, revolutionary? Because he is sort of, as you said, he's juxtaposing two completely different views on the predictability versus the chaotic happenstance of life.
Yeah, so I think it's viewed as surprising. Okay. So what Chaucer does is different to what other poets are doing. And I think that is, you know, one of the keys to his long-standing popularity, that he's doing something different and really right across his poetry. One of the key things that he does is this juxtaposition, you know, so putting together different views of life, different ways of seeing things. And one of the really clever things about that is that he can never be pinned down to one one point of view or another. So what we see in poem after poem is one speaker will take an idealistic perspective. Another speaker will take a very pragmatic or banal perspective on life. And you can't say which one of these views is Chaucer's.
I was just going to ask you, is it all him though? Just different takes, his different takes on things?
So Chaucer is the master of the idea of the unreliable narrator. Uh-huh. You know, something that we're familiar with from lots and lots of texts where you can't trust the narrator. And he gives us so many different narrators, so many different narratorial perspectives. And with none of them can you really say this truly is Chaucer. So it gives him this great deniability on the one hand. You know, he can always kind of say, well, it wasn't me saying that potentially revolutionary thing. That was my relator. You're crazy if you think that I'm that narrator. I'm not. He's just a fictional invention. But on the other hand, for readers, it allows readers to imagine that Chaucer is what they want him to be. So right across time, people have found the Chaucer that they want to find. So a later poet, Dryden, wrote that he said, well, as soon as I read Chaucer, I found that I had a soul congenial to his. And everyone thinks that about Chaucer. They all think, oh yeah, I really understand him. He's just like me. But that's because he is so varied and he always presents us with so many views of life.
Well, Marion Turner, professor at Oxford University's Jesus College and author of the new biography, Chaucer, A European Life. Hang on for just a moment. We have to take a quick break. We are talking about this new take, this new understanding of Geoffrey Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Marion Turner. She is a professor at Oxford University's Jesus College, and she has a terrific new book out. It's called Chaucer, A European Life. It's the first biography of Geoffrey Chaucer, the author of the Canterbury Tales, in a generation. And Marion has a unique new view on not only Chaucer, but the world he lived in the 14th century and why the Canterbury Tales remain so relevant today. So what's your question for Marion Turner? We're at 1-888-899-9287. And Marion, if I may, I just want to play a little bit more, an excerpt from an audiobook reading of the Canterbury Tales, because the Miller keeps popping up in this conversation. So the knight was the first to tell his story, if I remember correctly, in the Canterbury Tales. And then when he's done, the monk is supposed to speak next, but as the monk is about to start, the miller, who is a little inebriated, he interrupts because he wants to tell his tale, which ends up being kind of a spoof on the tale of a love triangle that the knight had just told. So let's listen to an excerpt from this moment in the Canterbury Tales.
The miller, that for drunken was all pale, so that unnethes upon his horse he sat, he would availen neither hood nor hat, nor abide no man for his courtesy. But in Pilate's voice he gan to cry, and swore by arms and by blood and bones, I can a noble tale for the nuns, with which I will now quite the knight's tale.
An audio excerpt from the Canterbury Tales. Marion Turner, first of all, explain to us why Geoffrey Chaucer has done this with the miller. Why does the miller butt in so early?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great moment, isn't it? And, you know, many of us have probably been in pubs or bars where someone goes, oh, just listen to me, I've got a really great story to tell. And so it's a wonderful moment. So, Yeah, so the tales begins as if it's going to be a hierarchical tale-telling contest. As you said, it begins with the person of most social importance. But only one tale is like that. And then immediately Chaucer has the miller interrupt and say, we're just not going to proceed like that. I don't care about hierarchy. I've got a great tale to tell. And of course, you know, unlike the drunken people that you're actually more likely to meet in pubs and bars, this guy actually tells a completely brilliant tale. So Chaucer shows us right at the start of the Canterbury Tales that it doesn't matter what background someone comes from, they might be able to tell an absolutely fantastic tale. And also, it is really key that he tells essentially the same story as the knight, this love triangle plot with a patriarch and a woman who's being exchanged between men, but he has a really different take on it to the knight. So again, that shows us that you might have the same kind of story, but if you hear it from different perspectives, you will think differently about it. Different people will put different spins on the same story. And then what's really important is that this is not an isolated moment. So it's not the case that we have the miller's interruption and then we go back to hierarchy.
Right.
Hierarchy is never reestablished. From now on, the tales are told organically. People interrupt. People say, well, I want to follow what you've said. I've got something to say. And we go on in this very organic way, which isn't dependent on having an external authority figure saying, okay, I'm going to put order onto this. So it's really about stories having their own life and circulating in the world.
Well, you know, we actually have a caller right now who has a comment about the Miller's Tale. So let's go to Amy, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I would like to thank Professor Turner for speaking so passionately about this work, because I too just love the Canterbury Tales. I wanted to share with you that my husband and I homeschool our children. We have two boys that are in seventh and fifth grade, and last fall we delved into the Canterbury Tales because it's one of my favorites. And we had two conversations out of that discussion. The first one was about pilgrimage and travel, and it just happened to be that we were studying the Canterbury Tales during the Islamic celebration of Eid. And so that conversation about pilgrimage was very timely. Mm. We also, specifically to the Miller's Tale, we read the Miller's Tale together and had a very long conversation because I was teaching the work and I'm mom and I have two very young boys. The Miller's Tale became a pretty lengthy conversation about the Me Too movement and about what it means to be getting in bed with someone without being invited. And what it means in marriage and those kinds of things. And so I just wanted to say that the Canterbury Tales is still very timely, and it is just packed with conversations that can be had about the here and now.
Amy, thank you so much for your call. Marian Turner, what do you think about that?
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for calling in. And I think it's just fantastic that you are reading the tales with your young children. And it's also striking that, you know, Meghna was saying earlier that she still remembers being taught the Canterbury Tales at school. And I find that, you know, I go into schools quite a lot and talk to students. And, you know, sometimes teachers can be a bit nervous about teaching the tales. But then when they go get through that and teach them, the kids almost always absolutely love them because they are so funny. They are so varied. There's so much wonderful imagery and language in them. And I think your point, Amy, about the relevance is also really important, because I think for me, one of the great joys of medieval literature is the way you get that tension between, on the one hand, it's so relevant, you know, the kinds of things that, as you said, the kinds of things that we can explore to do with gender relations or between the relations between different kinds of groups, these are relevant to every era. On the other hand, we also often have to make real imaginative leaps into this different world where many things are not the same. And so trying to do both of those things when we read about the past, I think, is just so valuable and productive.
Mm. Well, Marian Turner, I'd like to dig in significantly into the details that you write about in your biography of Chaucer and his life and the world that he lived in. Because first of all, you had before the break, you had talked briefly about how his family, they were merchants, right? They were vintners.
Yeah.
listeners.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can you first just describe sort of the part of 14th century London that Chaucer grew up in, that he had his earliest experiences in?
Yeah. So Chaucer was born in Vintry Ward. So London was divided into wards, which are like different areas of the city. And Vintry Ward was right on the river. So it's on the River Thames, because of course lots and lots of ships are coming in and out, bringing the wine from France. And Vintry Ward was the area of London that had more immigrants in it than any other ward of London. So Chaucer was mixing with lots of people from different countries. And at this time in London, it was an incredibly diverse area in ways that are quite surprising to people. So in Chaucer's day in London, you could buy spices that had come all the way from Indonesia, for instance, spices that today you can only buy in the Indonesian islands in which they are grown. But in the 14th century, there was this extraordinary spice trade where things would come along lots and lots of different middlemen across the Silk Road and eventually end up in London. So people were very aware of global trade networks, really. And for Chaucer, in the kind of, you know, although he was not of the top social class, he had a very wealthy and comfortable upbringing. And he lived in a world where everyone was multilingual, for instance, where educated men all knew English, French and Latin very well. And educated women knew English and French. They might not have had such good Latin. But he's living in a world where people are moving easily between languages. And Chaucer, crucially, picked up Italian. So he was living in this ward where there were lots and lots of Italian merchants. And it was really his knowledge of Italian that meant that in later life, when he was working for the court, he was the one chosen to go on trips to Italy. And then in Italy, he picked up manuscripts by these great recent Italian authors, such as Dante, Petrarch and Boccaccio. And his reading of those authors then really transformed what he could do in English poetry.
So along with that early experience with the 14th century version of global commerce, did Chaucer have a lot of experiences across classes as well, up to the aristocracy or even further or down as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So Chaucer really straddled different social classes. And I think that is one of the things that helps him to have such a unique perspective on the world. So although he was brought up in this mercantile environment, his first job was in what we call a great household. So he was working initially for the daughter-in-law of the king, so Elizabeth de Burgh, Countess of Ulster. And then he also worked for her husband, Lionel, the son of the king. And he went to war in Lionel's train when he went and fought in the Hundred Years' War and was in fact taken prisoner and ransomed. And later in life, he was then retained by, so that means he was paid regularly by John of Gaunt, another one of the sons of the king. And then he also got to the king's own household and worked both for Edward III and then for Richard II. So he did have connections very high up. And crucially, his wife's sister became the mistress of John of Gaunt, one of the most important men in the kingdom. And she had several illegitimate children by him. And those children were treated very well. He was not ashamed of them by any means. They were brought up with his own children and with Chaucer's children. So Chaucer had these very high up connections, but also in his everyday life, he was mixing with people of lower social classes as well, of course, in markets, with scribes, with the kind of people that he worked with in all the different kinds of jobs that he had.
Yeah. So when he was a teenager, that's when he was in the king's daughter's household as an adolescent page, right?
Yeah, the king's daughter-in-law. Yeah.
Okay, daughter-in-law. Okay.
Yeah.
Because you, if I understand this correctly, you are the first biographer of Chaucer to have picked up on a particular detail of this time in his life and explored it uncovered, I'm using that as a pun, uncovered with air quotes, what some of his experiences were while in the household of Elizabeth de Burgh. Because there's a particular word, a paltock. What is that?
Exactly. So the first documentary record that we have of Chaucer's life is not about him as father of English poetry. It's not of him as a diplomat or a great traveller or a customs officer. It's about his clothes. It's about him as a really fashionable teenager. So what we learn is that Elizabeth de Burgh bought him some new clothes. And these clothes were a paltok and some, which is a short tunic, and some striped hose, which are kind of leggings or tights. And so people have known about this record, but I then thought, well, what exactly were these items? And so I looked up lots of things in fashion history, what lots of contemporary chroniclers were saying, and I found out that these were, in fact, really scandalous items. And at the time, contemporary chroniclers were writing about them. And so one chronicler says these are parti-coloured and striped hose, which they tie with laces to their paltocks. They go about with their loins uncovered. Paltocks, extremely short garments, which failed to conceal their arses or their private parts. So these chroniclers are saying that young men are going about at this time in these very short tunics, which expose the fact that their tights, their leggings are very tight and are laced up so as really to show off the shape of their genitals. So Chaucer, as a teenager, was being dressed by a slightly older woman in these very provocative and fashionable clothes. And obviously that's a really interesting anecdote, because people don't think about Chaucer like that. People think about Chaucer as an old patriarch, not as a teenage boy. And I think it's also interesting because, you know, I was talking just before about both the familiarity and the difference of the medieval. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we think, okay, nothing changes. You know, teenagers wear fashionable, scandalous clothes which expose their bodies a bit, and older people go crazy and go, oh God, the youth of today, this is terrible. They shouldn't dress like this. But on the other hand, this is so unfamiliar because it makes us think about what it must have been like for someone to live in this very public way. So when you live in a great household, you don't go and do your job and then go home. Work and life are completely bound up together. So Chaucer lived in this household. The household wasn't one place. It traveled all around the country. They would spend a few weeks here and then they would move on to a different area, taking all their furniture and food and animals with them. He lived there. He slept there. He couldn't choose what to eat, when to eat. He couldn't choose what to wear. He had to lie down wherever he was told. He wasn't paid in money. He was paid in kind. He didn't have a room of his own or anything like that. He had no privacy, and he didn't have a private identity. So that is so different, so difficult for us to get our head around what it means to be a person when you have to live in that public way.
Marian Turner, let's go back to our phones because we have a lot of interesting questions coming
in. Great.
So let's go to Fernando, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Fernando, you're on the air.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Fernando.
Oh, I just thought I would be remiss if I didn't call and comment on how Chaucer affected us learning it in high school back in the mid-80s. I mean, I'm going to fly my nerd flag high, but, you know, back in those days we'd play Dungeons & Dragons, and how many adventures and stories did we tell that started in a tavern with a bunch of different people that otherwise wouldn't have gone together? I mean, That's where it all came from, you know.
Yeah.
And they're still doing it to this day. These kids, that's how they start their stories. Yeah. It's all from Chaucer.
Fernando, thank you so much for your call.
Yeah.
Marian Turner, what do you think?
I think that's great, and I think it's so important actually to remain aware of how alive Chaucer still is in contemporary culture. So, for instance, here in the UK over the last couple of years, these volumes have been published called Refugee Tales, which are stories told by real refugees here in the UK who tell their stories to poets and authors while doing the Canterbury Pilgrimage Walk. And these stories often refer to the Canterbury Tales themselves, but also, of course, conceptually, it's all about that idea of let's get a diverse group of people together and hear their stories. And I think lots of contemporary authors and people who are not authors themselves are all really interested in this very dynamic idea that Chaucer had.
Well, Marian, we just have about a minute and a half before the break, but I was wondering if you might just treat us with a little bit of another reading from the Canterbury Tales from a moment on when he talks about a treatise on the astrolabe.
So this is a different text, not the Canterbury Tales,
but a separate text that
Chaucer wrote. So Chaucer wrote this, and one of the lovely things about this is he wrote it for his 10-year-old son. So it's a scientific treatise, and he had bought his son this special instrument called an astrolabe to help him to learn to tell the time. And at the beginning of this text, Chaucer says, But natheless, suffice to thee these true conclusions in English, as well as sufficeth to these noble clerkes Graecas these same conclusions in Greek, and to Arabians in Arabic, and to Jews in Hebrew, and to Latin folk in Latin, which Latin folk had him first out of other diverse languages, and written him in her own tongue. And I think this is interesting because it reminds us that Chaucer was really aware of a multicultural world of learning, that he knew that he was, when he was writing this text, his main source was a Latin translation of an Arabic source. And Chaucer was very aware of this world of learning, not only from across Europe, but also that had been preserved in the Middle East and North Africa, and that was also coming from Spain, much of which was Jewish and Muslim at the time. So Chaucer was very aware of this diverse world in which he lived.
Well, Marion Turner, professor at Oxford University's Jesus College, professor of English, and author of the terrific new biography, Chaucer, A European Life. Hang on for just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Marion Turner. She's a professor of English at Oxford University and author of the terrific new biography, Chaucer, A European Life. And Marion, before we go back to the phones, because we have a lot of callers, this may sound like a rather ignorant question, but I am so enamored of the way you read the medieval English out loud. I mean, how do you know exactly how it's supposed to sound?
Wow. I mean, people have traced this through, people who are experts in historical linguistics have traced the way that the language has changed and developed, and also looked at things like rhymes, for instance, and how words have changed across time. I mean, there are a lot of people who are a lot more expert in that than I am, I must say.
Well, it just sounds wonderful to the ear, and it actually helps make, because I have to say, to my modern eyes, it's a little hard to make sense of some of the words on the page, but to the ear, it sounds much better, which actually makes me wonder. I mean, Chaucer wrote the Canterbury Tales. Mm. Was it meant for only a literate audience, or was it ever read to people?
Oh, it was certainly read out loud. Okay. Yes, absolutely. And a really interesting thing, actually, is that in Chaucer's day, if you were reading, even if you were on your own, most people would read out loud. Which I think is so interesting, because it means we're so used to reading silently, but actually it's a very different experience if you read out loud and you kind of taste and hear the words yourself out loud, as well as, you know, as well as silently in your head. But certainly he often actually draws pictures for us of contemporary reading experience. So in one of his texts, Troilus and Crusade, in book two, he gives us this scene of Crusade sitting with her ladies, and one person is reading out a romance while the others all listen. And it's kind of like a medieval book group, you know, but you actually read the text out loud, and then you can imagine people can then discuss it. And quite often in Chaucer's texts, things will be said that prompt discussion. So at the end of one of the Canterbury Tales, for instance, the teller asks a question. He says, who was the most frey, which means generous? Which of these three people who've all just done things, which of them's the most generous? And you can imagine that after that was read out to a group, that you'd pause and everyone would talk about it and give their opinions.
Wow. Well, let's go back to our group, our phones. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. Just going back to what a previous caller, Amy, mentioned, I took a high-level Chaucer course in university, and when we read The Miller's Tale, it kind of seemed like I was the only person that understood that a sexual assault had occurred. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was almost shocking that my classmates actually hadn't even realized that it was essentially a rape. Because for them, the way Chaucer tells it, it was kind of funny, and they missed the really big picture.
Yeah. Alex, thank you for your call. So Marion Turner, Alex is exactly right in her take on The Miller's Tale here, but this gives us the opening to talk about Chaucer's own life. Mm. Because there's what an allegation or even a conviction on him in terms of sexual assault. Is that right?
So there's not a conviction. Okay. There's an allegation, and that allegation is then by a woman called Cecily Champagne. And that allegation is then withdrawn after he pays her off. So For a long time, critics debated whether this allegation, so it's an allegation of raptus, and in other contexts, this can mean abduction rather than sexual rape. And for a long time, critics tried hard to think that it wasn't a sexual assault. But now I think from lots of critics have looked at lots of different documents and contexts, and I think most people agree the accusation is an accusation of sexual assault. So then we get into the question, of course, of, but what can we know about whether he did it or not? And I think this is such a difficult area, because I think if we're talking about the modern moment, our current moment, I would always say, well, you know, you believe the victim, you believe the accuser. You know, the idea of false allegations are so vanishingly rare. But of course, when we're talking about different legal systems, things are not the same. So we're talking about a legal system in which, in order to make an accusation, you did not have to produce evidence, for instance. And there are certainly cases where people make these kinds of accusations for, and then it turns out that it certainly was not a sexual assault that occurred, that they have been made for a different purpose. So, and I think it's, you know, people have very polarized opinions about this, with some people saying, you know, of course he couldn't have raped someone, he's so nice about women. And that's really problematic, because someone can write all kinds of things and behave in a different way. On the other hand, you have people saying he was a rapist, and I don't think the evidence shows us that either. And, you know, I think in the end, there is a real uncertainty here over what happened. And that's a difficult thing for us to accept. But I think there is an uncertainty.
Did the accusation come before or after the writing of the Canterbury Tales?
Before. So in the middle of his writing career, he'd written other things, but it was it was several years before he embarked on the Canterbury Tales project.
On this note, several reviewers of your new biography of Chaucer note that you're the first female biographer. Of Chaucer.
Yeah.
And then they go on to say that perhaps it's because of that you actually pay very close attention to the women in Chaucer's life.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, how important it is to essentialize us in different ways. You know, so you kind of think, well, am I interested in this because I'm a woman, or because I'm a mother, or because I was educated in a certain way, or because it's the 21st century, you know. I mean, you know, we're all many things, aren't we? But I think it is certainly true that, I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is that I've really found out some interesting things about Chaucer's daughter, Elizabeth, and no one's ever really been interested in his daughter before, because all we have is these brief life records about her going into a nunnery, and that has kind of closed her down for lots of people. But what I did was I went and did lots of investigation into that nunnery. And it's called St. Helen's Bishopsgate in London, and the church is still there. And I found out some fascinating things. So in particular, there was a visitation on this nunnery. So a cleric went to see what was going on there just shortly after Elizabeth had been there. And he wrote this report that says things like, okay, nuns, you've got to stop dancing and reveling, partying quite so much. Only do it on proper party days. Don't do it all the time. And he says, don't have so many strangers coming in and really not sleeping in there with you all the time. That's not okay. And prioress, can you sleep in the dormitory and in your rooms, and don't go and sleep in places which are causing scandal? And I won't say any more about that now, but you all know what I mean. So there's these really, it's just amazing, so interesting. And I think that, you know, one aspect of that is also that none of this means that the nuns weren't devout, that they didn't pray, but they also had fun. They had a nice time.
That is definitely not what I expected to hear about
That's right.
a 14th century English nunnery. But speaking about the women in Chaucer's life, we have to talk about the wife of Bath in the Canterbury Tales here. So let's listen to a little bit of an audiobook excerpt from the wife of Bath's tale. It's read by Frances Jeter here. And in this portion, the wife is saying, quite frankly, that if women could tell stories or had the opportunity to tell more stories, that perhaps men wouldn't always come off so well in those stories, or women portrayed so negatively.
And trust ye well, a clerk is never liable to speak the smallest word in praise of wives, unless he write a book about saints' lives of others not. Tell me, if ye are able. Who painted Aesop's lion in the fable? By God, if women set to writing stories, as do these scholars in their oratories, they would have told more wickedness of men than all of Adam's race could write again.
An excerpt from The Wife of Bath's Tale in slightly more modernized English, we should note. So, Marian Turner, what's the significance of The Wife of Bath?
So, yeah, where to start? I mean, that is such an important moment, I think, where, you know, she says things that women have been saying for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, and back in the 14th century, she was saying it. Okay, there's so much anti-feminism about, there's so much misogyny, you know, she's saying, and she's saying, why is there so much evidence that women are bad? Because it's all been written by men, and women have not had the chance to tell their own story. The pen has not been in women's hands. And so she uses this example of who painted the lion, which is from a fable about a lion, saying, well, you know, men have drawn pictures of me in a negative way, but if I'd drawn the pictures, they'd look different. She says, you know, if women had had a chance, then we would be giving the opposite perspective. And of course, I've been talking earlier today about how important Chaucer thinks it is to hear lots of different perspectives. And here the Wife of Bath says, well, women need to be heard. We need to be able to tell our own stories. And a really interesting thing about the Wife of Bath is that Chaucer refers to her in lots of other Canterbury tales. So he makes her into an authority. She is, in many ways, his favourite character. She's someone that he seems to be more interested in than he is in his other pilgrims. So in The Merchant's Tale, in The Clerk's Tale, the Wife of Bath appears. And even in a short poem, which is not within the Canterbury Tales, he mentions her and he says to his friend, read The Wife of Bath. So he makes her into this authority figure, this author, even though, of course, she is not a real woman. But he's trying to put forward this idea of female voices and the importance of trying to create a space for women to tell their own stories.
Huh. Fantastic. Well, let's go back to our calls. Matt is calling from Union, Maine. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really looking forward to the book coming out. I'm an amateur historian myself, that I focus mostly on Geoffrey's son, Thomas Chaucer.
Great.
I do a lot of research on him. And I was wondering if you talked about his daughter, Elizabeth. I was wondering if you'd talk about Thomas, who was a highly influential man for his time, and not that much information out there on him either.
Yeah, absolutely. So I talk about all his children, so the ones that we know about, Thomas, Elizabeth, and Lewis. And as you say, Thomas was a really important man who became Speaker of our Parliament many times in the 15th century. He was brought up in these very exalted circles, largely because of the family connection with John of Gaunt. So, as I mentioned, the fact that his aunt was John of Gaunt's mistress and later wife, so she became the Duchess of Lancaster. So Thomas was very much brought up in those Lancastrian royal circles, and he went with John of Gaunt to Castile in Spain, and John of Gaunt set up a crucial marriage for Thomas to someone called Maud, who was a great heiress. So again, we see women being very important, because that was really what gave Thomas his big leg up, that he got this wealth and lots of land through his wife. And if you ever visit the UK, you can go and see Thomas's tomb, which is in a little village near Oxford, a little village called Ewelm, where Thomas and also his own daughter, Thomas's daughter, so Geoffrey Chaucer's granddaughter Alice, is also buried there. And they're really beautiful tombs, and it's wonderful to go and see them.
Marian Turner, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I wanted to play a little sound first and then ask you a question about something that I'm just going to coin as the Speaker's Tale, okay? So here is actually the current Speaker of the House of Commons in the British Parliament, John Bercow, in one of his more, you know, characteristic moments in the recent debates over Brexit. So here he is.
Order. The honourable gentleman has got to learn the art of patience. And if he is patient, if he deploys Zen, he will find that it is ultimately to everybody's advantage.
That's the current Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow. Now, you recently wrote a piece that connects Chaucer to the current state of affairs in Parliament. What's going on there?
Yeah. So what I have a chapter in the book, actually, about Parliament. So every chapter is about a different place or space. And one of them is about Parliament. And so the really interesting thing is that the role of the Speaker of the House of Commons came about during Chaucer's lifetime. So in 1376, there was an important parliament and the role of Speaker developed. It works slightly differently today, but its origin was that in Chaucer's time, you have the Commons and the Lords, which we still have today. But in Chaucer's time, the Lords were the really important ones. And the Commons did not have much of a say, as you can imagine. Though in comparison to other European countries, the Commons did have power because they could withhold or grant taxation. So they did matter. Our parliaments always had a greater role for those less important people. But they were used to not quite having their voices heard. So in 1376, they developed this idea of the Speaker, where one person would speak for all. And this is genius because it stops the Lords from being able to divide and rule. So one person will come forward and he would say, I'm speaking for everyone. Hmm. And it also allows him not to be punished because he says, these aren't my own opinions. So back to this idea of deniability in the Canterbury Tales. You know, he says, these aren't my own opinions. I'm speaking for everyone else. Don't punish me. I'm speaking for the whole group. So it's really relevant to Chaucer, I think, both because it foregrounds the importance of hearing ordinary people's voices, you know, letting these ordinary people actually have a say in political life and making those voices matter. Mm-hmm. But it's also a really clever way of doing it. And Chaucer uses some of the exact same words that the Speaker was using as this role mm-hmm. developed over the next few years. He uses those words in the Canterbury Tales where lots of speakers will say, you know, well, don't blame me for what I say. I'm putting this under correction. I'm not saying this is the final word. I'm just putting perspectives out there. You judge for yourself.
Well, Marion, if I may, we've just got a minute to go here. And there's one last question I do want to ask you, because your scholarship on Chaucer is so deep and your enthusiasm for him is so infectious. I was just wondering, how did you fall in love with him? Like, where did this passion come from?
I think, as we've been saying, a lot of it comes from good teachers, doesn't it? I mean, I also studied some Chaucer at school and then at high school and then when I got to university. But I think also the thing that actually really first really captured my attention about Chaucer was when I read his poem called The House of Fame. And that is a poem which is all about the idea that you shouldn't just read the books that people tell you to read. You should experience all kinds of things. So the figure in it, and he's Geoffrey, he's a figure who's very like Chaucer himself. He goes to the House of Fame, he sees all the canonical texts, and he says, I'm not getting inspiration from this. And so then at the end, he goes back to this very dynamic space and he hears the voices of ordinary people and he listens to that. So as well as reading the great books, he also listens to stories at his doorway in the real world and he puts all that together. And that's, I think, the message I'd like to put out to everyone. You know, read everything, try it all, and then make your own decisions.
Well, Marion Turner, professor of English at Oxford University's Jesus College and author of the new biography, Chaucer, A European Life. Professor Turner, it has been a great joy to speak with you this hour. Thank you so very much.
It has been a real pleasure, Magna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.